Romans chapter 3, verses 1-20. And I suppose it's true to say that this evening we get to the end of the bad news of the gospel, the bad news which precedes the good news, which starts in verse 21. Reading then from verse 1, what advantage then is there in being a Jew? Or what value is there in circumcision? Much in every way. First of all, they have been entrusted with the very words of God. What if some did not have faith? Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? Not at all. Let God be true and every man a liar, as it is written, so that you may be proved right when you speak and prevail when you judge. But if our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly, what shall we say? That God is unjust in bringing his wrath on us? I am using a human argument. Certainly not. If that were so, how could God judge the world? Someone might argue, if my falsehood enhances God's truthfulness and so increases his glory, why am I still condemned as a sinner? Why not say, as we are being slanderously reported as saying, and as some claim that we say, let us do evil that good may result. Their condemnation is deserved. What shall we conclude then? Are we any better? Not at all. We have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands, no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. Their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways. And the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in his sight by observing the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. Amen, and may God add his blessing to this reading of his holy word. Now you may care to turn with me to Romans chapter 3, which we read together earlier. You may remember that we have already suggested that one of the best ways of understanding Romans chapter 1:18 through to 3:20 is to consider the whole of mankind in a vast arena and the Apostle Paul standing before them in the role of chief prosecutor, whose aim is to demonstrate the guilt of the whole of humanity in the presence of God. so that the immoral man and the moral man and the religious man discover that they all stand under God's condemnation. And it's significant that only the religious man, in this case the Jew, answers back. He begins in chapter 3 to ask, what is the point of being a Jew if I am placed in the condemned cell with the rest of mankind? You may remember back into all that we had to say in chapter 2, where Paul had demonstrated that wearing the badge of circumcision did not guarantee immunity to the Jew, nor did knowing God's truth keep the Jew out of God's dock. The Jew's question is one which many church people might ask today. What is the advantage of baptism? What is the advantage of being a church member? What is the advantage of learning the Bible if we are going to be dealt with on the same principle of justice as the rest of mankind? Well, listen to how Paul answers his Jewish questioner. In Paul's mind, the greatest blessing of the Jew is that God had entrusted him with a special revelation of himself. Not only did he possess God's written law, but also the covenant promises of God to which the Jew found himself bound to God. These things had been entrusted to the Jew in order that he might accept them by faith, obey the requirements of the law and the covenant, and communicate these truths of God's grace to the other nations. And it is at this point that Paul anticipates a further objection. What happens? What happens if Israel proved to be faithless to her trust? This question and Paul's answer are to be found in verses 3 and 4. What if some did not have faith? Will their lack of faith nullify God's faithfulness? No, not at all. Let God be true and every man a liar. You will notice that the NIV translates faith instead of faithfulness. Both these words are closely connected. Faithfulness involves the exercise of faith. And I want to suggest to you this evening that the context of the passage requires us to translate faithfulness rather than faith. For it is man's faithlessness which is being set over against God's faithfulness. That's the context. The Jew's faithlessness to his trust is uppermost in Paul's mind. The Jew's unfaithfulness does not, as far as Paul is concerned, nullify his advantages. Let me try and illustrate that. A young man is enrolled by his family in a college course. They undertake to pay all his fees and to ensure that he has the very best teachers and the very best tutors made available to him. All the textbooks that he requires are made available. This young man also enjoys good health and he is blessed with above average intelligence. But in spite of all these advantages which are his, he never graduates. Why? Because he has frittered away his time. He has been lazy and unfaithful to his trust. Opportunity and privilege which were his did not guarantee success and blessing. Throughout history and in our present age, many have been wrongly persuaded that opportunity and privilege does guarantee success and blessing. But let me say it again. Opportunity and privilege does not guarantee the blessing of God. Well, if some Jews have failed to take seriously the advantages offered to them by God and fail to walk in obedience and faith with God, does that mean that in condemning them, God has broken his covenant promise to them and so proved himself to be unjust, unreliable, and unfaithful? The fact that God could be accused of unfaithfulness causes the apostle to blow a gasket. And the response of Paul in verse 4, "not at all," is far too weak a translation, because the force of the original language carries something like, "perish the thought." Never in a million years. The faithfulness of God is a two-edged attribute. We must not concentrate upon the faithfulness of his promises at the expense of his faithfulness to his threats. You see, often people only listen to what they want to hear, and when things do not work out for them as they expect, then the one whom they consider has failed them and failed to produce the goods and the success that they anticipated, that individual is vilified. Think of the child told by his parent, "tidy up your room and I'll take you to the park this afternoon. But if the room is not tidied, you will spend all afternoon tidying it." Now, what happens? The child neglects to tidy his room. But nevertheless, after lunch, gets very excited about the prospect of going out to the park. And when his parents refuse to take him, he accuses them in his heart, if not openly, of failing to keep their promise, when in actual fact, that is precisely what they are doing. The child had paid attention to the first part of the promise, to the part he was interested in, going to the park. But he had failed to give weight to the second part. An untidy room means staying at home. That is how the Jew and how many church people behave towards God's promises. They edit out God's threats and sanctions, and then they accuse God of being unfaithful when the blessings they expect do not materialize. Defending God's faithfulness, Paul places it over against man's faithlessness. This is the significance of the phrase, "Let God be true and every man a liar." And to illustrate the meaning of that, Paul then quotes from Psalm 51, one of the penitential psalms written by David after his adultery with Bathsheba. You will remember the story. Immediately after his adultery and deceitful arrangements for the murder of Bathsheba's husband Uriah, David began to live a lie. He attempted to deceive others, himself and God, into believing that all was well. And into that situation, God sent his prophet Nathan to expose David and his faithlessness. And it was that encounter, you will remember, which produced the confession and the repentance which caused David to write the words quoted here. Where David, against the dark background of his own unfaithfulness and unrighteousness, seeks to make God's righteousness and faithfulness in judging him righteously shine all the brighter. David wanted God to be magnified as one who faithfully deals with his people. Now, when two things are contrasted, they have the effect of acting as foils, highlighting each other. You may or may not know that this is the secret of Rembrandt's paintings. The bright highlights which he achieves in his painting, which makes you wonder if he had access to brighter colours than his contemporaries, are only possible because of the exaggerated dark tones with which he surrounds them. It is the deep darkness which causes the lights to stand out in sparkling brilliance. Now, in the same way, it is against the blackness of human faithlessness and unrighteousness that we see something of the faithfulness and the righteousness of God stand out in remarkable brilliance. Now, it is Paul's contention that this is so, which causes his imaginary objector to shout out yet another question in verse 5. But if our unrighteousness brings out God's righteousness more clearly, what shall we say, that God is unjust in bringing his wrath on us? Is man's sin, therefore, magnifying God's righteousness, not making it shine more brilliantly? Is it therefore fair of God to punish men for enhancing his character by their wicked behavior? That's the objection. When I studied architecture more years ago than I care to remember, a new professor arrived at our department and proceeded in the course of his lectures with great regularity to blaspheme Christ's name. And when in private he was challenged about the language he used, he was quite surprised. And he sought to justify his behavior by claiming that every time he used Christ's name in vain, he did God a favor. For he was introducing the subject of Christ into the thinking of his students. And as a result, he felt that God should reward him for his behavior. Now, it is that warped thinking which Paul confronts here. For its deep darkness makes the righteousness of God all the more attractive. That's what the objector is saying. Deep darkness, great sinfulness makes the righteousness of God all the more attractive. Can God really be annoyed at that? Isn't God being unrighteous in punishing wickedness? And again, we find that Paul objects in the same strong language to that perverse thinking which is beneath contempt. You see, it is because that God is a God of impeccable justice that he can be trusted to judge the world. David was a man after God's own heart, but God didn't let his choice friend David off with his adultery. Verses 7 and 8 point up the warped reasoning Paul has already exposed. Paul does this because some of the opponents of the gospel had suggested that it provided men with a license to sin. As we will shortly discover, at the very heart of the gospel which Paul preached lay the grace of God in all its glory. And Paul will argue that human goodness can never satisfy the demands of God's justice. Only God's goodness can satisfy those demands. God provides in the gospel the very righteousness which his justice demands of men, and which men are incapable of providing for themselves. But you see, Paul's opponents twisted this teaching in such a way as to give the impression that Paul was saying, since your goodness is to no avail, since your goodness will never earn God's favor in the business of salvation, go out and sin to your heart's content. Have a sin binge on the grace of God, in order that God's grace may do its work in your lives. Paul's response to that is simply that those who pervert the doctrine of God's grace in this way will get, verse 8, what they desire. Let's try and draw some of the threads of Paul's argument together now. What has Paul achieved to date? He has shown that every single man, no matter what their background or morality or religious pedigree may be, they stand on the same level, under the same sentence of condemnation. In the words of verse 9, Jews and Gentiles alike are all under sin. It's not enough to be moral. It's not enough to be passionately religious. And it is vital to notice that the Apostle Paul, the prosecuting attorney, places himself with the rest of mankind now in the arena with the words, "Are we any better?" No, not at all. The gospel provides no room for one man to consider himself the moral superior of another, or to look down his nose on others like the Pharisee in the story which Jesus told. "Lord, I thank you that I am not like this publican here in the corner of the temple. I am his moral superior." The gospel provides no room for that. For the Christian, by nature, belongs to the same lump of sinful, fallen humanity as the rest of mankind, and for that reason has no room for boasting. And in order to substantiate his charge of the sinfulness of all men without exception, Paul quotes a whole string of Old Testament quotations, and we won't go into them in great detail this evening. The picture, though, that he paints here of human sinfulness is dismal. There are no exceptions. Notice again and again, he tells us, all have turned away, all have sinned. No one does good. The whole of their being is tainted by sin. He is describing in these verses what theologians call total depravity. That, of course, doesn't mean that men are as bad as they can possibly be, but rather every part of man, his intellect, his emotions, his will, every part of man is tainted by sin. So much so that there is no such thing as human goodness. By nature, there is no such thing as human goodness. The impression a great many people give is that there is both good and bad in man, and there is a great struggle in his heart for the ascendancy, the one over the other. But man, by nature, is incapable of pure goodness. There is no one, says Paul, who does good, not even one. Every man's best deeds are tainted in some way. When the philanthropist denotes a new wing to the hospital, his motives can range from a desire to be well thought of by his contemporaries and by history. He may be hoping for a knighthood in the New Year's honours list. His giving of the hospital wing could also be motivated by a guilt in his heart, seeking to make amends for the suffering which he has perhaps created as he has built his great financial empire. We cannot read the motives of men's hearts as God can read them. And what the apostle is saying here is this: that men, even the very best of men, by nature, when they seek to do good, and that good seems to all concerned to be truly good, that good has been tainted in some way. You'll notice that in these verses, the illustration which Paul uses to persuade his readers of the universal nature of sin is not as we might expect. The gross immorality which marked the heathen world, but the sin of the tongue. Verses 13 and 14. Their throats are open graves, their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips, their mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. How often our speech betrays our sinfulness. Not only when we speak in anger, attempting to hurt others, but when we flatter or paint fanciful stories in order to deceive. The apostle then moves from our daily speech to our actions, verses 15 to 18, and to the catalogue of pain and the bruised and battered emotions we leave in our wake, to say nothing of the physical harm we are capable of doing others. And the reason for such a proliferation of wanton violence, verbal and physical, is given at the very end. There is no fear of God before their eyes. That is true of man by nature. Paul, you will remember, had earlier demonstrated that everyone was under the law. The very worst of men have God's law written on their hearts. They are without excuse. The moral man who goes as far as to acknowledge the benefits of law keeping and yet fails to keep that law is also without excuse. The religious man, and in this case the Jew, to whom God's written law has been entrusted and yet breaks the law, is without excuse. Every man has been shown as a failure in the business of law-keeping. Why? Why? That the whole world might be silenced before God. When the prosecution finishes at the bar of God's justice, there simply is no case for the defense. There are no excuses. No one is found daring to justify their lawlessness and sinful behavior. There is nothing at all being said by way of defense. It's a dramatic silence. When we were in Iran and trying to learn the language, one of the Farsi English grammar books we used contained a very quaint expression, "But me no buts." The compilers of the book mistakenly assumed that this phrase was in common usage in this country. Its Farsi equivalent was, however, regularly used. Whenever a child did something wrong and was being reprimanded by its parents and began to justify its behavior with a sentence that began, but, the parent's immediate response was, "But me, no buts." It was a phrase which called for silence from the guilty party. And that is precisely what Paul's argument has done up until this point. He has said to the whole of humanity, "But me, no buts." He has dealt with every excuse which man might raise in his defense. And the result of that is the silence of the whole of humanity before the presence of a holy God. You see, it is only when men are silent and faced with the seriousness of their condemnation before God and their inability to do anything about it, that their ears are attentive to hear the good news of the gospel. The clamoring heart, which is constantly justifying itself and making excuses for itself and busily running about trying to redeem itself, will not be receptive to the gospel. But the man who has nothing at all to say in his defense, the man who is able to look back on his life and see its folly, is ripe for the grace of God in the gospel. I firmly believe that in our evangelism, we need to pray more for and work towards persuading men of the necessity of this kind of silence. For until men's mouths are stopped by an appreciation of the sinfulness of their lives, they will never be filled with the experience of God's grace and forgiveness. And if this silence is necessary to bring a man into the kingdom of heaven, it is also, I would suggest to you, necessary for our growth in that kingdom. For it is as our mouths and hearts are silenced before God that we begin to recognize our own inadequacy and our own need, and recognize afresh God's ability to supply a sufficiency of grace to meet that need. This, I believe, gives added meaning to the psalmist's words, "Let all the earth keep silence before God."